All right. Welcome back to Millennial 2019. This is the second of four Hangouts tonight. Sorry, not Hangouts, streams. And I'm here with the fantastic Austrian... Thank you. What was it I decided to call you? The Austrian intellectual Überstern. Überstern, yes. Martin Lichtmess. So welcome, Martin, or Lichtmess, as I often call you.
Thank you, Colin, as I often call you. Glad to be here. Thanks for the praise.
Yes. There are plenty more to come. Martin has been on my two previous millennials, 2017 and 2018, and he was very popular, so I was very eager to get him on this time. But I am sorry to everyone. I am very sorry about the technical issues that were plaguing us and prevented us from beginning 50 minutes ago. So we'll try to make this a fun-packed but also intellectually stimulating 1 hour and 10 minutes before the Franklin comes on. So, Martin, what would you like to talk about with the... Would you like to talk about the decade that's just passed? Well, that is about to end. We've got another 4 days left of it. The 2010s. What would you say about the world compared to what happened in the world, to the world, in this decade?
Yeah, we previously talked about it, that this might be a thing to discuss. That didn't come so much to my mind. I just realized that we are again in the 1920s. Which were an interesting time in the 20th century, and also a time I'm very interested in. And, I was found very fascinating, silent movies and Weimar Republic and whatever. So strangely enough, we are in the 1920s again, which is sort of weird. It shows how old we are. And I was thinking about the previous decade. I mean, there's a curious thing that I don't know if you agree, but somehow decades, they seem to lose their distinct character. When I think of the 70s or the 80s or even the 90s, I have certain kinds of music in my mind and movies and hairstyles and so. And then it becomes strangely, 2000s. I mean, I remember these were the Bush times, and now 2010s. I don't see these distinctions. So this is so clear. I don't know what the reason is for that.
Well, I mean, this is something that I've said before. I don't think the 2000s really had much character. I don't think, culturally speaking, even politically speaking, but definitely culturally, I don't think much happened then in the 2000s. I don't think there was much going on. And so it's difficult to look back on the 2000s and think they don't have a sort of appearance on the historical continuum, that there isn't much there in that place. So I would say that in this decade, things have livened up a lot compared to the 2000s with things like Antifa, Occupy, the alt-right, the dissident right, identitarianism, that kind of stuff didn't really exist in the 2000s. In terms of the mainstream, technology has taken off. Social media has taken off. Wi-Fi, smartphones, that kind of stuff. These are the things that have come up in previous conversations this millennial.
That's true. Did you read the thing that was going on that supposedly the 2010s were the greatest decade in human history?
I didn't see that. No,
no, for some preposterous reasons and so on. Well, I mean, look, I mean, if we talk politically, let's think back. I mean, I only can talk for Germany or Austria mostly. I remember that in 2010 in Germany, there was this sort of feeling that finally things are going to change. I was hanging around at the New Right in the late 2000s, so I was already publishing in some papers and so, and I was entering this scene, and there was this feeling of a constant, you were in a waiting room all the time. Nothing ever changed. And of course, all these things that were issues like multiculturalism, they're already back then, but not for, I mean, only for a small segment of people. I mean, there was Antifa already and all that kind of thing. And then in Germany, this book appeared by this guy, Thilo Sarrazin. He's still around. He's a card-carrying member of the Social Democratic Party.
He's left-wing, sort of old left, center-left.
Yeah, more center-left. Let's say the right wing of the Social Democrats. He's a realist, first and foremost. And he had this book, which was a bestseller in Germany, like Deutschland schafft sich ab. Germany does away with itself. Germany abolishes itself, if that is the correct translation. And he was talking about all kinds of issues, like he was talking demographics, he was talking about education, he was talking about economics, he was talking about Islam and all these kind of things. And the book was very dry, full of facts, and it became a bestseller. And back then, this was 2010, and back then everybody in the right-wing conservative scene said, wow, this is it. Now the change will come. People are waking up. Everybody is reading this. People are discussing this finally. Here's a guy who's from the mainstream. He was a guy from the mainstream establishment. All of a sudden, he comes with all these issues. Usually, only the right, the right-wing conservative fringe talks about. And it was kind of frustrating to see how easy it disappeared. I mean, it was there, but nothing really was changing. And so I remember, in 2011, there was, there was a sort of trauma happening. And this was the Breivik thing in Norway. I saw it was horrible. There was a huge, of course, sort of witch hunt on German papers. Everything that was center-right was now deemed Breivik. He had this manifesto, which was essentially a mix of a diary and a copy and paste of thousands of articles he had read, including by this one blogger, which was very interesting, Fjordman. So everybody who was in the manifesto could be indicated. And it was a horrible thing. And back then, I was quite interested in...
It's worth saying that Fjordman was a counter-jihad type. He was always at the Vlad Tepes blog, which was a set of... Basically, they were civil, what we would now call civic nationalists, CivNats, who were just concerned about Islam. And it was a very one note kind of thing, where not racist, not concerned with demographic replacement, mass immigration, or even multiculturalism, but just radical, violent, the radical violent side of Islam. So, yeah.
Yes, but I must say Fjordman, he went a step further. I did translate a few of his essays back then in Germany, and he was considering demographics. He was actually going very, very deep. And back then I was much more interested in this Islam thing than now. I was more into this back then, not 10 years ago, more in this counter-jihad thing.
Yeah, so was I. I think most of us were.
Yeah, I guess this was an early 2010 thing. And of course, all of a sudden, Breivik appears and there you go. And the next thing that happened, if I recall, it's now also a long time ago. In Germany, there was this strange thing that, this is a little bit longer story. Okay, there was an elite...
That's okay, we've got time. It's fine, it's enjoyable. Okay. Yeah, it's enjoyable.
I hope it's not boring. Look... It was in the same year when Breivik came. So there was a strange witch hunt atmosphere. And of course, back then me and a friend, we decided to publish Fjordman's essays. This was already planned before the Breivik thing happened. But we decided to do it now because we wanted to have, okay, what did Fjordman actually write? You have to sort of save it from this contamination, from this misuse, so to speak. So, an intellectual has a responsibility. What do you do when a madman comes and takes some of your ideas and uses them for criminal things? I mean, it happened to Martin Selner, for example, this year. you remember, was another of those ugly things that are part of a bigger ugly picture that is, I think, increasing.
Well, and also Greg Johnson, of course, was falsely painted by the Norwegian authorities as a supporter of Breivik.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, go on.
Yeah, so the next thing I remember was in the same year, 2011, this story blew up that there were these three guys, two men and a woman, and they were from the far right, let's call it really neo-Nazi scene in East Germany, and they had been missing for a decade at that point. They were going underground because of some minor propaganda delicts and so. And all of a sudden, they were up there again. And this story was that the two guys, they had shot themselves while the police was after them. There was the woman who she burned up the apartment where they lived in, and she got on trial. And these three people allegedly had killed, in the course of 10 years, Turkish kebab shop owners. Just because, you know, just because they're racist and they hate them. And the at that point, the last murder had been years ago. A policewoman was also shot. So there were a dozen of murders that were contributed to them. And the media had the story right up there. It said, okay, their organization was called the National Socialist Underground, and it's a case of right-wing terrorism.
I don't think I heard about this. Which country was this?
You did not? Wow, okay. Well, it's a huge story in Germany. It was a huge story. So it was in 2011 when this thing
happened. Right. Yeah. I don't know how on earth I missed this.
Okay, this is weird. I mean, because there was this story. There is a threat, a neo-Nazi terrorist threat. And, of course, we must do something about it. And the story was fishy from the beginning because who has heard of a terrorist that doesn't create terror? I mean, normally political terrorists, they create an, I don't know, act of terror, and then they say, I have done it because of that. But these people allegedly had killed the kebab shop owners just, you know, for racist reasons, and only years later they would admit it in a weird video that was appearing. It was leaked through the media, I think through some Antifa group, I don't know how they got it, and showed in the murders, and there was the Pink Panther cartoon figure. I'm getting really down in the rabbit hole now. I think I should stop now. The point is, you know, it was a real weird fishy story, and very soon it became clear there was involvement of the what is it called, the Inlandsgeheimdienst, you know, the intelligence service for the interior, the
secret services.
Yes, but those that are supposed not for foreign relations but for interior relations, and allegedly these three were on the payroll of the secret service, and many, many more details cropped up. So finally, the one woman who was went to court, and the trial went for years, she never said a word. She never confessed everything. She just kept silent. And of course, there are lots of speculations on it. But the story was there from the beginning that there is a sort of neo-Nazi threat to Germany. But if you looked at it critically, you realized there was something wrong. It was a sort of fear-mongering. I do believe for certain it is a hoax. I mean, there are whole websites dedicated to it. There are books dedicated to it. So this is a story. But I remember this is how the decade started. There was this setup, like these three people, these three National Socialist Underground terrorists are not just far-right extremists, but they reflect what the center of society thinks, what the majority thinks. This was the story. You know, it was the murders, they were sold as a sort of micro holocaust, so to speak. You know, Merkel, she was already in charge back then. She would hold speeches, and streets were named after the victims and all that. So there was a huge cult unfolding, a huge ceremonial cult. And if you compare it to Just 5 years later, in Berlin, there was an Islamist terrorist attack on a Christmas market. And also a dozen people died. And this time the victims did not get the same treatment. So you would not even know their names. There were some papers, you know, some alternative media papers that had to find out their names. Merkel did say a few things, but there was not this cult unfolding. So this is what made me write the book in 2017 or so. It was called The Hierarchy of Victims. And this is important to understand that if you have victims within the framework of multicultural society, you have a hierarchy, which is also based who is the victim and who is the perpetrator, right? So we have two kind of terrorist things. One was a terrorist attack, which was clearly one. And the other one is a rather fishy story. And in one case, the story is taken as a reason, as a pretext to accuse the whole of German society. They say, you know, they are coming from us. They are the racists. Wow. We have to look in the mirror and see we are like them. We have to change our ways. And they were used, of course, as a sort of scaremongering against the right. But I'm pretty sure it was some Secret Service intelligence.
Well, this happens a lot where there will be some terror attack by some jihadis, some Muslims, and the message from the media is we must not use this to vilify, demonize all Muslims. But sure. Anything happens on a racist thing by white people against foreigners, then it's all white people. The message from the same media is all white people have to answer for this. Racism is all throughout our society. Islamophobia, anti-Semitism are all throughout all of our society, and we're all implicated. So it's a completely different mentality. You know, basically, whatever is bad for us is used. So when we can be vilified completely, we are. When we can be switched off from caring about mass immigration, we are. It's difficult not to see it as basically an attack on, it's a psychological attack on white people, I would say.
Yeah, well, I remember that back then when this alleged NSU story came up, I wrote a few articles called Who Are the Terrorists? I mean, who is terrorizing whom? So my thought was, it was rather a thing of the state and the media terrorizing people who were, you know, against multiculturalism and such. Of course, there were calls for more observation, more security, more, you know, the things that are done when there is terrorism, like in the US in the 2000s and so. So you got this strange feeling, there seems to be a strange involvement of secret services. And at the same time, the state is calling for more observation, more restriction, this was before hate speech came up, and you thought, might there be a strange connection here going on? And today, everything is blamed on Alternative für Deutschland, Alternative for Germany, which is, okay, this is also something that came up in 2013, I think. But the groundwork was laid by Sarrazin in 2010. So there was a whole range of issues, and they were not addressed by any of the mainstream parties, certainly not the so-called conservatives.
Well, this is throughout the whole West. I mean, there are these issues which are not being addressed by any of the mainstream parties.
Yes, yes.
From down the decades, you know, from the last 50 years, really, the Labour and the Conservatives in Britain have just buried any opposition to mass immigration.
Yes, so there was a need for a party that addresses it. So, Alternative for Germany started originally as an anti-euro, the money, the currency, European Union critical party. And the immigration issue slowly, rather quickly, came into the foreground after some time, because it was just there. Somebody had to pick it up. It was important. And eventually it would be one of the most important things for that party. And yes, so this party is going to be blamed. And of course, in the mid of that decade, I don't think I need to talk too much about it because everybody knows the so-called
migrant crisis.
Crisis happened, and Germany was at the center of it. As Angela Merkel, she opened the borders. There were huge, huge waves of people coming through the Balkans and all that, and this created a shock inside Germany. Created a big polarization. Gave fuel to the rise of Alternative for Germany and woke up many people to issues that others already had on their mind years ago. So today we talk about there are these late coming populists or right wingers. They just woke up in 2015, while people like me were aware of the issues in 2005 already and some even earlier, because this is a process that has been going on for decades and people really get used to it. Like the story of the frog boiling in the water, you know that story. You throw this.
Yes, of course. Very well. I think we're all very familiar with that metaphor.
But you know this, yeah. So yeah. So well, I think if the decade started with Breivik and NSU, these were forgotten faster than I thought, because the issues that concerned people were there too much, and they rose and rose. And at the same time, okay, you have a certain rise of populist parties, of alternative media, but at the same time, I feel it's like it's just the level rising. The level of the problems is rising. You know, all these kind of parties and media should have been there 10 or 15 years ago before it rose to that level. There was too much tolerance, so to speak. There was too much not caring about it. People would say, well, it's not that bad and it won't become that bad. And but if at that point people would have been, let's say, less tolerant and, you know, more seeing what's going on, they would say we have to stop it. But people are not like that. They just realize when it's too late, and still there are not enough people realizing.
But what? Why do you think that is? And well, why do you think that is?
Well, okay, that is a bigger question. I think people don't like to think about things that are unpleasant, and also, you know, they live in a world that is basically the world we live in and the values that are there are mostly created by the media. The feeling that we live in a society where these and these values matter and these people matter and these opinions matter. This feeling is created by the media. You turn on the radio and you hear what everybody hears. I mean, radio, okay, or TV or internet. And then you are connected to the rest, and the media has become a sort of a block that tries to create an image that doesn't correspond with what many people are experiencing in their daily lives. And now some people react that they say, "Oh, it's Lügenpresse, you know, the lying press, the lying media. It's all wrong." But many people are afraid to depart from this. They feel like, maybe I am wrong. Maybe it's not so bad, because it's hard to let go of this. It's hard to let go of the trust you may have had in the media and politicians. I mean, I do remember a time 20 or 25 years ago, when people did trust the media and they did trust politicians in our country. They said, of course, we're not blindly following it, but in all, they are meaning well and they are doing their job. And this has changed in the course of the last 20 years, that there is a big mistrust in politicians, there's a big mistrust in the media, and to let this go. I mean, a friend of mine told me when he had this so-called process of red pilling, that it was so hard for him to let it go, to realize maybe these papers are not telling the whole truth. Maybe these papers are biased. Maybe you can see things differently. He said it felt like you're all alone all of a sudden. You don't know where to look at.
Oh, it is a difficult thing for many people. Mm. I'd like to ask, how do you think, I mean, it's nearly 4 years, or it is 4 years, since the migrant crisis. It was never a crisis, of course, but that's what it's called outside of Germany in the Anglosphere. It's known as the migrant crisis. That when, well, it started with the boats coming into Lampedusa and at the start of the 2015, and then Merkel just insanely opened the gates in September 2015. That's more than 4 years ago, and of course Cologne happened, the assault, mass sexual assault happened just a few months later. It's incredible, really. Anyway, that's 4 years ago now. How do you think that the migrant crisis has affected Germany and the German people and German culture and German politics?
Well, here's one thing that I felt even back then when it happened, that strangely enough, it hit the point in many Germans. It's part of the national character, the need or the urge of doing something good, of doing something for the common good. So, in fact, Germans always used to be people who are more, let's say, they have a more of a social attitude towards things. There's an old word which has also been used, of course, in the 1930s, called Volksgemeinschaft, which means Gemeinschaft. How would you call it? It means like it alludes to the idea that the people, no matter which part social part are you are, which class you are, should have a feeling of solidarity. They should belong together, and they should have a common idea of what they are as a people. So,
God, that's just so. I mean, how can you do that when you're a mishmash of different religions and, you know, cultures and
certainly you can't when you are, but. A strange thing happened in 2015, that there was a sort of Volksgemeinschaft based on aiding refugees. You know, all of a sudden, there were these good, brave, well-meaning Germans, starry-eyed idealists. They were all there at the train stations welcoming the refugees. The media were appealing to this idea, like, now we are united again as a country. Together we help people, we are doing something good. And some, of course, would say this is part of the guilt complex. You need to make up for it. You need to do something good now because you think your ancestors have done something very bad. But there was more to that. I felt there was something moving about it, but in a twisted, in a perverted way. The people were mobilized by this feeling that they crave for, of belonging to a greater common group, serving for a greater common good. And Germans love this. They always loved it. It's part of their national character. They want so much to be good. See? And this whole mobilization back then was a sort of expression of this need and the national character. And but at the same time, if you were an outsider looking at what's happening and you saw the insanity of it, you saw the weirdness of it, you realized, okay, these people want so much to do something good, but at the same time they are working at their own doom. No, at their own doom.
Well, exactly. That's the thing. This people have been persuaded to work hard towards their own destruction. It's really just
they weren't aware it would be the destruction. They had very naive assumptions of what was going to happen, and many would not change their minds when things like Cologne happened. You know, others would from the beginning realize something is wrong here. This is really mad, but others would not. And here's the thing that human beings, they don't like to change. They don't want to realize their mistakes. I mean, I remember recently I read a very interesting book. I forgot the author. It's an American author, American journalist. She wrote about, it was called Willful Blindness. And it was about this idea how everybody of us has blind spots, how everybody of us clings to ideas. And when these ideas turn out not to be true or turn out to be bad, there is a reluctance inside of us to accept this. We don't want to see our mistakes. We don't want to abandon our beliefs. And so, and she has some examples, one of which is very famous. There was a study about some sect in the United States in the 50s, and they, like many, believed the end of the world would come at a certain date. And they thought only them, they would be saved. And when the end of the world did not come, most of them did not abandon the beliefs. In fact, they had worked up already new thoughts how to, in fact, foster their belief, like saying, wow, it was our devotion that saved us. They came up with thousands of explanations just to keep the framework intact. And the same thing is happening also here. Many say, we don't want to believe that this is wrong. We don't want to believe that our will to do good might have
created. Well, and you see this playing out with, especially with, and I don't want to pick on the baby boomers, that generation, but you do see this playing out with them in Britain and in America as well, where they just, like, Americans need to believe that America is the America they've been told it is all their lives. And yeah. And the British people need to believe in well, the same thing, in the same narratives, and that the market is all that matters, and all that anyone needs is money and opportunities. They don't need identity, they don't need history, and so forth. I think this is a... I don't want to, as I said, I don't want to pick it solely on the baby boomers, but I think that generation have a... there are things about them that seem to be relevant to all of this. What would you say about that?
Well, it has become a fashion to pick on the baby boomers.
And that's why I want to be careful what we say, because it's not fair. Obviously, the other generations are involved as well.
I almost want to run to the defense because they get picked on so much. It's surely, as you say, it's not just them. It's in fact everybody. I mean, young people nowadays, the younger they are, the more likely they are to vote for green or socialist parties, which is, of course, part of being young because you believe this kind of shit.
I mean, even you and I were fairly liberal. I was extremely liberal as a teenager. I think you were less liberal, but you were still pretty liberal, weren't you?
I would say yes. I mean, these were very different times in the 1990s. You did not feel the urge or so. For my part, I would say I was not political for a long time. It didn't interest me so much. You know, I was more into art and literature and all these kind of things. And it was only at a certain point I realized that my tastes in that, they were corresponding to a right-wing mindset, which I did not know that was there all the time. I mean, even today, I consider myself a fairly liberal person in the actual.
It's so funny because I think so many mainstream liberals, progressives, if they heard you and me saying that we consider ourselves quite liberal. I think they'd be outraged by that notion.
Well, what I mean by that, I mean that I'm actually fairly tolerant. I mean, I don't understand these kind of people who want to deplatform everybody, who want to dox everybody who has a different opinion. I don't feel the drive to do that, only in self-defense. I mean, we are in a sort of a war now against people who want to do the same thing to us. But you know where I'm heading to. And but the point where we started was that we said that young people are inclined to be more leftist, liberal, have more utopian ideas or so. And being a conservative or right wing often comes with maturity, with age. I mean, there is the classical thing that when people settle down and they have children, all of a sudden they are concerned about things they were not before, and they become more, you know, conservative, more worried about the children, which school they will attend, and more about safety and all these kind of things. So, I mean, this is a perennial thing. I mean, you have maybe heard that line. It's a quote attributed to several people that says, if you are a socialist, if you are not a socialist with 20 years, you don't have a heart. And if you are still, when you are 40, you don't have a brain. Right.
Yeah, I remember laughing out loud the first time I heard that many, many years ago.
there's some truth to it. I mean, I never was a socialist. I hate socialism. I mean, I hate thinking about social things. No, now not anymore. Now that I'm mature, I think there is a social question, a class question also, because I tend to think about things. But back then, 20 years ago, I was thinking more like some, you know, some kind of Baudelaire damned artist who despises the masses and who doesn't care about social issues and all that. So, but this is a silly juvenile thing.
Yeah, yeah. What about what's that? Oh, Bismarckian, that kind of idea of having a welfare state? I mean, that I've seen that described as the first sort of version of socialism.
Hmm. Sure. In Austria, we had a very good welfare state. But by now, of course, there's the problem with immigration. The welfare state just gets completely, its meaning gets reversed. Because all of a sudden, you have people migrating to your country only because there is a welfare state. And then you have these Muslim Turkish families with four or five kids, and they live, they just, you know, this was not, was it, what, this is not what the state was supposed to be for. So, this is the point. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, these boring discussions with libertarians. I mean, some people say migration would not happen if there were not all these social or socialist welfare things that are being promised. And others say, no, it's in fact a libertarian thing because big business companies, they want open borders. And the curious thing is that both things might be true, because we have a combination of the worst of both. We have a combination of the worst of capitalism and the worst of socialism.
I think I hate libertarianism even more than progressivism. Because it's just so nihilistic. I mean, at least progressivism is aiming for something. You know, libertarianism is really just leave me alone, let me jerk off to infinite porn, and don't expect anything of me whatsoever. And also, I'm cleverer than everyone else. Which is reprehensible.
Yeah, it's also naive in a way. I mean, because in fact, also libertarians, even hardcore libertarians, they profit from a common good. They profit from a state that creates schools or that creates highways or so. I mean, they have this one big enemy, the state. Always, it's always against the state, no matter how this state is like. And it's also a sort of sociopath egotism at work here, I think. You know, and there are some parts of it I like. I mean, if you read some Ayn Rand novels, I mean, I did not read them actually. I saw only the movie with Gary Cooper, The Fountainhead from 1947. It's an awesome movie, and you get the myth of it, the myth of this, you know, individualist, creative guy. So there's a poetry to it, which is great. There's a poetry in Ayn Rand, which is great, a myth in it, but you should not take it too seriously. It's not a serious political philosophy. There's a truth in it, but it's not a serious political philosophy, obviously. This is why, I mean, libertarians are very boring, also very predictable.
There's not much that they say. It's extremely one note. They don't seem to actually be interested in dealing with the human condition as it is. They just want to talk about their ideology, and human nature will just have to catch up with their ideas, which are extremely simplistic ideas about freedom. This is the laziness of it. I find repulsive the fact that they're so ready to just have dismiss all the possible problems, and all the fact that their ideology would actually be, it would, I think it would do a lot of harm to people. I think it would be an assault on human, on the soul. And yet they don't seem to have any interest in this possibility at all. That they're so myopic. And I really hate them, actually. It's like talking with an adolescent. It's like a 16-year-old boy who thinks he's just really clever and he's hitting the solution, and he doesn't care yet about the rest of the human species. But the fact is, we're not talking about 16-year-old boys. We're talking about men in their 30s and 40s and 50s. And that's what's so bad about it. It's like they've never grown up. But anyway, let's not go on about libertarianism too much, because I know that I may be being simplistic and caricaturing them. I know that, but I kind of think they deserve to be caricatured. I kind of think they don't deserve a fair hearing. Because they're just contemptible. All right.
I say some of my best friends are libertarians, so I try to be fair.
Okay. Some of my best friends are libertarians. Like,
Go back to the 2010 things. I mean, maybe they are still too close. I don't see it really as some really. I mean, I can remember things that happened. I mean, certainly in the USA, whatever happens in the USA has an influence on the rest of the planet. And these were certainly the Obama years. They were very important.
Yes.
I think when Obama came, he was sort of designed as an anti-Bush. People were fed up of Bush and all this neocon shit and Iraq wars. And then you had this guy with a strange name. And there was a very good marketing campaign. You remember the hope and change thing. The aesthetics were appealing and it worked quite well. And of course, wow, finally you had the first black, so to speak, he was mixed race, actually, president. And people would talk about the post-racial America a lot at that time. But the ironical thing is, I think this needs to be pointed out, that in fact the opposite happened, that during the Obama years, America became obsessed with race and racial things.
Well, indeed, he was supposed to be the first post-racial president. It's 11 or 12 years ago now, but some of us will remember this. I remember this. That's what they were saying about him when he was voted in 2008. He was going to be the first post-racial president. And of course, everything just got much worse.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is people forget. Some people believe that this vicious polarization also between the parties, the really intense enmity and hate, only started with Trump, but it started way before under Obama. Here's a book that I always recommend to read. It's an American psychologist called Jonathan Haidt. I think that's the way you
pronounce it. Oh, yes. I really should read that book.
The Righteous Mind. And it's quite an interesting book. It's the anatomy of political dissent and polarization based on value systems. So he has a set of values that are everybody has, but some people have more, put more emphasis on certain values than others. Is it more loyalty, or is it more fairness? Is it more respecting institutions and authorities, or is it more justice, social justice, and all that? And this book was in 2012, I think. And in the foreword, he says America is more divided than ever before, and in a way that it never was. Like, it has become a real vicious hate between the parties and the groups.
I don't think this is because of Obama, though. I think that it happened in spite of Obama. I actually think I wouldn't be surprised if he wasn't all that bothered about race baiting and creating a. I mean, I know he did some of it, but I don't think it was this sort of mad progressive that you see now in America. I mean, it's a long time ago now. You know, Obama, that's actually, as I say, that's 11 years ago.
Well, compared to today's Democrats, Obama seems like a conservative moderate in many respects.
Yes. Although somebody's pointing out that he did fan the flames of Ferguson in 2014. And of course, Trayvon Martin, he said, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon, with the gold.
There was a lot happening even before Trump came on the scene, and people who were blind to this did not see it. So, of course, I mean, the changing demographics in the U.S., they would become more salient. So I guess this is also part of it. And this progresses, of course, with each year. This is the decade when identity politics really came to the US, I think, in the 2010s. I mean, it started in the 1990s, but I think it was really upfront in the 2010s, I guess.
For sure. And what would you say about the place of identity politics? Because one of the things that people like Sargon say is and even the alt-right, is that identity politics is very bad. And if we could just get rid of it, which, of course, we can't do at this point. It's far too late. But they'll say if we could only just get rid of it, then everything would be fine again. Because identity politics is poisonous. It's destructive. What would you say about that?
How can you divide identity from politics? This is the first question. Because if politics is an interest of a group, this group does have to have a certain identity. So if it goes back to the Greek, the polis, and you're a part of the polis in Athens, for example. So you have to have an identity of being part of that polis. And within that polis, there are groups that have certain interests. So probably the very word identity politics is a misnomer. It's only there because there's a context that there used to be an identity that is being undermined by minority identities, which are trying to introduce something new, which are sort of splitting up, which was a thing everybody was taken for granted before it happened. So, there's this famous quote, which is falsely attributed to Bertolt Brecht. It says, imagine there's war and nobody is going there. And the second part is, then is war is coming to you. And the same with identity politics. It's a sort of low-level war. All politics is a sort of low-level war. There's the famous distinction of Carl Schmitt. He said, politics is based on deciding who's my friend, who's my enemy. And certainly identity politics is the same. You cannot escape from it. The moment one group enforces their will, in a context of undermining the identity of another group, in this case the majority group, there's no way of escaping from it. And some people try to sort of transcend it and escape into a higher sphere where they say, can't we have a sort of roof you know, a sort of intellectual, spiritual, constitutional roof that says, under this roof, we are all fine and okay. I mean, this has been discussed a million times on our channels. And of course, I think it's an illusion. It can never work because these roofs are always built for particular kinds of people who have to agree with the basics of this roof. And if they don't, well, you can forget about it. So
yeah, it's going to be identity politics between those groups.
There's no way out of it. You know, it's sad in a way, you know, but I think that, I mean, let's say it like this. We are talking about the identity politics of the majority, of the still majority. Let's simplify it and say in European Western countries, white people. Okay, simplify it for this. So white people are those that are not allowed to have identity politics. But they always had an identity and identity politics even before minorities came in. Only most of them were not aware of it because this is the way you live. This is the way that was taken for granted. This is the thing that was there. And only when you get this intrusion, when you are getting questioned by other groups who take more and more space, who take more and more access to public life, then you realize who you are or where you stand. It's not magically happening at that moment. You just get conscious about it. That's the point. So I think most thing about white identity politics is just getting conscious about it because somebody on the outside is labeling you as such.
Yes. Yes, I completely agree. I think it's naive to think, I mean, as you say, politics is identity. There are no real politics without identity politics. It's always part of it. It's always for whom are these political maneuvers intended? Who are they intended to benefit? Which people? And usually, you know, ideally, it's all of the people in this country, in Germany, in Britain. It's the British people, whatever. But then when there are, and it's them against foreign countries, foreign peoples, or in cooperation with foreign peoples. But then when it's multiple peoples in the same country, then of course they're going to have different interests. So of course they're going to, then identity politics is going to emerge. I mean, this is inevitable. And I think in this context, I mean, just to wrap this up, it's basically if the natives of each country don't, like the Europeans, if they don't have identity politics, then they're going to get trampled by the identity politics of other groups, other peoples.
Sure, because they are in a weaker position. They do not dare defend themselves. They have been told that it's immoral to do that. They feel like it's more clever, more noble to give in, to you know, open yourself up. And well, I guess it's a fallacy, huh?
Yeah.
But, you know, this is an issue that we talk about a lot. I mean, maybe there are a few other things we can talk about until our time runs up.
Oh, yes. Well, let's finish. We've got about 15, 20 minutes left. So let's talk about the Franklin is in the chat. So I think he'd probably be okay with us going a little bit over time. Although he does have a healthy dose of German punctuality about him, which... Okay, let's talk about our survey of the decade, the 2010s. We got to the migrant crisis. I asked you, how did that affect German culture? Would you like to give a sort of brief, quick answer to that? What have been the effects culturally, politically, of the migrant crisis?
Well, okay. I think things I said before that... there's a polarization in the country. There is a rise of the alternative for Germany because this people realize there are some positions, some interests no other party is taking care for. And I also think that something has accelerated this feeling of that Germany finally has to become a more diverse country, so to speak. So this vision of Germany being this more multicultural thing, which you know is an idea for many. You have to say this. I mean, some find it abhorrent, some see the mostly negative sides of it, but there are still substantial many people who believe in it and who can imagine such a vision, and who also say that, look, finally, it's already happened. There's no way back. I mean, demographics show it, especially in the West. Some cities are already, you know, the minority of Germans are already a minority. German births are a minority. So I guess I'd say this very idea that this could be the future and there's no way to get away from it has entered the minds very much. I mean, listen, the thing is, I've been in this right-wing thing for 15 years, and I feel, in fact, that nothing really substantial is changing. There's only a degree of intensity that is rising and changing. But I feel it's the same story repeated over and over and over again. Huh? And for example, also the background when I hear the media talking about Nazis, you know, and when historical things are being used for present day politics, you see the same patterns all over and over again. And at the same time, these historic events, they are more and more and more further removed in the past 60, 70, 80 years and so, and still the media is presenting it as something that is relevant today. History is repeating itself. I remember when the Boris Johnson votes came out, you know, and it was clear that British people would vote for Brexit. There was this one German, Austrian philosopher, Ulrike Garro. She's an European Union shill, so to speak. And she's completely crazy. She's also dumb, but she gets platforms everywhere. She's kind of an ideologue for the coming European Union Republic, she calls it, which would do away with nation states. And she would write on Twitter, this is how people in 1933 must have felt when Boris Johnson got all the votes. So this is the way these people think. They say they don't ever leave this framework. They say the right wingers are backwards. In fact, it's them who are backwards. They are always thinking in these terms of the 1930s, and they don't realize times have changed. I mean, there are some right wingers who are also in this trap, of course, but I think they are not the majority of it. I think it's our mainstream liberal globalist European Union shills who are in this trap that they think 1930s are always repeating themselves and are always there. And I must say, it's kind of depressing looking back at the past decade, how little, in fact, has changed. You know, I started talking about Thilo Sarrazin in the beginning. I remember when that book came out, I was writing for a weekly conservative newspaper in Berlin. And it was not them, but it was my publishing house. We had these stickers printed of Thilo Sarrazin in the style of the Obama icons, the Obama Hope and Change icons. So you have this basically three colors, and it's very stylized. And we were using red, black, and gold, the German flag colors. So it was Thilo Sarrazin in this Obama style, and the reading was Change, you know, in German. I think it was, we were using the word Wende, which was the word which was used in 1990 for the big change. And I remember I went through Berlin at night and I put up stickers everywhere, and I had this feeling, it's happening. There's a change of the minds. And, now 10 years later, I realize, yes, some people have changed their minds, but, there are even more people who are still clinging stubbornly to the old ways, which they think they will be the ways of the future, the globalist, multiculturalist ways.
Is that because they are of the older generation, baby boomers and older, who need to keep believing in that stuff? Or is it because they're young and stupid and brainwashed at universities and so on?
both. I mean, this is not an age thing, I think.
Oh, I know, but there are probably different factors for the different age groups, I would imagine. Look,
I mean, I think it's also that many of the young ones, they grew up and they knew nothing else besides that. They already grew up in a, so to speak, diverse society. They know no alternative. Some may wake up because they realize bad things. But, of course, the feeling of a national identity in general is decreasing. At the same time, the teaching of you know, World War II guilt and all that is still there. And if you have young people at school today, what they are talking about are their great-grandfathers by now, which is weird. I mean, my great-grandfather fought at Isonzo in 1916 at the Italian border. I didn't even know him. You know, he died decades before I was.
Well, it's really interesting because obviously native Germans are supposed to feel really bad about this. But what about the Turkish, you know, the new Germans? Are they supposed to feel bad about World War II? Because they're as German as anyone else, obviously.
Of course, they don't. I mean, they're like Algerians in France. It's even worse because Algeria was a colony. I mean, they are using it as a weapon against what they call the potatoes, Kartoffeln. These are the ethnic Germans. And I mean, if you would ask them about the Armenians, for example, oh, you know, they would rather deny it or downplay it or say, you know, they deserved it, or it never happened that way. So certainly it does not work. And this is the way you see who's really German is the one who feels the guilt.
Exactly. It's like when liberals say, well, I don't know what you mean by white. And so the answer is, well, it's whoever you would say should have, who has white privilege. Mm-hmm. And the same way, who's German? Well, whoever you would say should feel bad about World War II.
Implicitly, this is about being a descendant in blood of people who lived in World War II and the 30s.
It's an implicit admission that there is such a thing as ethnic identity.
It is, and the sad thing is that this is the last sort resort of ethnic identity. That some people don't have anything else but that. It's a perverse way to stick to your ethnic identity.
It's really silly. I mean, if you can feel bad about World War II, then surely you can feel good about the other things.
You can feel good about good or whatever. Yeah.
If you've got mind. Exactly. If you've got the right to feel guilt, then you...
Why not? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you've got the right to feel guilt, the duty to feel guilt, then surely you've also got the right and the duty to feel proud of the other things.
I mean, I think in general, well, let's say maybe it's not especially a German thing, but in general, people have troubles integrating both. That they say, we look at the history and we see both good and bad, but hey, it's our history. We accept it. Overall, we are proud. We are glad about it. Because Germans have this idealistic tradition in their mind and in their thinking, they find it hard to have, they want it either black or white, so they find it hard to accept both, which would be a healthy thing. I mean, it's also, you know,
somebody's asking, are the Germans not even proud of normie things like their car brands, the car manufacturers?
Oh, this is an interesting question. Yes, I think quite substantially many Germans are. You know? I remember 10 years ago, there was a huge, I review the book. It was a huge, I think you would call it coffee table book. Does this exist? Some book with lots of pictures and you can browse through it and so. And it said 100 reasons to be proud of Germany. And it was quite funny because you had products like, hey, we have Mercedes Benz and we have this thing. And then you had certain people and characters, I don't know, some politicians or some writers or whoever. And I felt it was terrible. It was horrible. It was just it was sponsored obviously by some company. So basically these were all things that were these were just products to consume. You were supposed to be proud of, you know. There were a few things in history, but this was all in the line of the usual narrative. And some people you were supposed to be proud of were just terrible people. Like, I don't know, I should be proud of Alice Schwarzer. She's the feminist queen of Germany, who used to be around since the 1970s. By the way, she gets a bashing now by a younger generation for being right-wing because she's critical of Islam.
Oh, yes, I know. I think I've heard of her, yeah.
She's one of the few feminists that consequently sticks to her line of criticizing the patriarchy and so. And so this is why she's deemed right-wing by now, which is really, really ironic and funny and so. But, you know, I remember this book and I thought it was horrible because it was just shallow, superficial things. I mean, it's okay to be proud of German efficiency, of German products and so. I mean, there's a long tradition of it, but this is not all of it. And I remember I wrote a very sarcastic review on this book, and then I started to quote the German extremist, and this is Kleist, you know, the famous poet from the time of the Napoleon Wars. And he was very nationalist back then, and he had this catechism of the Germans, and there would be a question and answer, and the guy who is giving the answers, he says, well, I mean, I don't love my nation because it's the greatest. If I think of the Greeks or the ancient Egyptians, they were far greater than we are today, or they were equal, and so I love Germany because it's mine, it's my own, you know. It's my homeland, you know. It's not because we are the best, we are the greatest, we are so. And the thing is that real love doesn't need reasons. It's unconditionally. It's because what you are, you know. And I thought it would be very shallow and superficial to.
Yeah, I always think it's kind of disgusting when people, usually civic nationalists, I have contempt. I'll admit it, I have contempt for libertarians and civic nationalists. I'll admit that I'm biased against them. However, it always disgusts me when civic nationalists say, well, here's why I love Britain. So we'll talk about Britain. And they'll say, well, we did this and we invented that. And so on. And it's like...
We beat the Nazis in World War II.
Oh, yes, of course.
We have a democracy, we have values, we have and all this.
All that, and I'm thinking, right, okay, so what if we hadn't done those things? Would you not love us?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the individual putting his country on trial and saying, okay, I'm going to judge you, and if you pass the test, then I'll love you, or then I'll care about you, but otherwise, sorry, pal, you're on your own. I mean, that's incredibly egotistical, and I think also delusional. I think it's really delusional. It's like they think, I've got to have some justification for my affection, because otherwise it's just irrational. Yeah, it's not logical. It's completely, I was going to say autistic. It's just delusional.
Mm. Yeah, it should be like, okay, we are entering, of course, a bit ambivalent territory here. I mean, if I love my family, right, it's also without any conditions, just because it's my family. But everybody knows a family can also be very troubling and stifling. And you can feel the same about your country.
This and you should. I think that's a healthy attitude.
Sure, of course. I mean, if you look at the great poets of any country, they would always struggle with their country and the issues, you know. They would not just say everything is great and wonderful, but they would often chastise their country. They would often, you know, be the worst critics, but also out of a feeling of love, a sort of, you know, real patriotism. I don't want to sound too cliched now, but of course, real patriotism has to involve being being critical, being sharp, right? You're not, it's not a blind love, you know, it's, but it's also something that, well, I mean, you know, this book I mentioned, it made me think a bit. There were other books that tried to have a different approach. For example, I remember one book, which was a writer. He was a German from ethnic minority in Romania. Yeah. And they also have a peculiar national conscience. His name is Richard Wagner, curiously. He's not related to the composer. And there was a journalist called Thea Dorn, and they had a book about the German soul. And it had to be very big because you have to tell a story. It's not something that you write down like a checklist. You know, it's this and this and this. It's like discipline, it's sauerkraut, and it's, you know, so lederhosen or whatever. It's not a checklist, but it is something that has grown. It's something that you have to know and that has a story, a long story. And I mean, I think people who talk about diversity too much, they often don't have a real respect of other people or cultures. Because you realize this, when you are a tourist in a country, you can like it on a superficial level, and then maybe you live there for some months, maybe some years, and you learn things that are not so easily understood by a foreigner. Like, you know, social things, things in atmosphere, things in mentality, that what people call the soul. So, but you realize it's there when you live with it, when you encounter it. And then you cannot just put it on a checklist and say it's this and this and this, but it's something you have experienced with your senses and intellectually and all that, you know. And I think this is a question that gets asked the most when you talk about multiculturalism and who's going to be part of our nation and who not. And always these wisecrackers, smart-ass people come up and say, well, what is German anyway? Can you give a list? And it's easy to make fun of it.
I hate that so much. It's one of the tricks I most despise. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, it's a dishonest trick, but for some people maybe it's not so much dishonesty, but they really have lost the connection. They have forgotten what it is. They are so detached. They haven't experienced it anymore, and maybe they become overly rationalistic about it, or even cynical, or whatsoever. Still, you know, my emphasis is that it is there and it has to be experienced. And here's the thing, maybe we should talk about this some other time, because we talked about it in private, that sometimes I feel that many people who are active in the political sphere, who are nationalists or patriots, often are too much focused on these certain political issues, but they do lack, in fact, the knowing or understanding of their own country, which is paradoxical. Do you know what I mean? That I think that they sometimes it's people who are not political, or who are in their head. The head is in the mainstream sphere, but their lives are somewhere else. Their lives are really in there. You know, they are really in the country, in the language, in the way people are. And the head is maybe somewhere else. And sometimes there are right-wing intellectuals. The head is there, but they are not really connected to the people. They are not really connected to the country.
Yes.
And I must say, I experienced this quite a lot with American right-wing intellectuals. I mean, some of them have gone to Budapest or other countries of Europe. They don't identify with the US too much. They identify often with a more abstract idea of, you know, I don't know, European culture, or the white race or whatever. But I feel especially American right-wing intellectuals are sort of alienated or estranged from that which they are talking about. This doesn't say that what they say is wrong. It's not, you know. Often they just hit the spot very well. But sometimes I feel that in their personal lives, they are really not there. They are really not connected. They want to be there. Maybe they think about it so much because they are not there. Do you?
Yes.
What I'm talking about.
Yes, I think that sometimes nationalism or national, whatever you want to call it, identity politics is it can be an overcompensation for feeling detached from normal modern life. I think that is a danger. But I think that I don't think it's wrong for that reason. I just think it can sometimes emerge for reasons that aren't healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And then those people can be a bit too vociferous, a bit too black and white, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's bad. I just think it's something that it's something that people should be aware of. So some people are saying that, okay, I'll ask you. You were saying earlier about nationalism and you don't see much changing. Do you think in Germany and Austria, would you say that you are schwarz-pilled?
Schwarzbild.
Damn, I mispronounced it. Okay, go for it.
Schwarze Pille, yeah, genau. Well, I can only speak personally for me, you know. I mean, I'm sort of a black belt person in constitution. I don't know. I
mean, melancholic Martin.
There's also a tradition in Germany, especially Vienna, about this sort of mindset and so. You know, I guess I can really answer that. I mean, life just goes on. I'm not despairing at the moment, but I'm also not hoping too much. I mean, there was a lot of disappointment going on in Austria. I mean, we could have filled the whole program with this. Like, you know, a year ago, we had a quite nice center-right populist government, which we were hoping would finally do something good. And this government now has blown up, mostly by its own fault. You know, the Freedom Party, our populist party, is unfortunately made up of corrupt people, imbeciles and cocks, and they just missed their chance. What is now impending is a coalition between the Conservative Party and the Green Party, which will be really, really fun. So, I mean, I see also the comedy of it. And this is a thing which is probably what saves me from absolute despair, is that I do have this Austrian mentality of not taking things too seriously, of looking at life like some sort of theater, like some sort of story, but, you know, full of sound and fury, probably signifying nothing, and it's also fun in a strange way. I think I have told you before that one story after World War One, when people in Berlin said, well, the situation is serious, but it's not hopeless. And in Vienna, they would say, situation is hopeless, but not serious.
All right.
This is a very Austrian way of thinking, you know, of not taking things too serious and so. And I think it's also, I think in my way of looking at the world, it's also a conservative thing. Because, you know, utopians, socialists, they're always so serious, you know. They always want to, you know, they worry about things that have to be changed or otherwise, you know. And you know, the conservative mindset says, just let it go, let it happen. There's a reason why things are there. I mean, I give you an example if this is too abstract. Look at this new fashion of the left. It's like the climate change thing, you see. And I don't want to go too much into that. I mean, so I think there are ecological concerns, but obviously there is some strange apocalyptic mindset emerging here. Like,
oh yes, with Greta Thunberg and all that.
Yeah, they just Extinction Rebellion. These people, they freak out if you doubt man-made climate change, and to think if you don't believe it, then the world has to end. You just have to believe it. Otherwise, you know, it's that serious and so. And some people even compare it, you know, to Holocaust denial if you deny climate change. So they're taking it that serious. And I see this, you know, there's no sense of humor anymore there. There's no, you know, well, how shall I say it? There's a word by Heidegger, which is not, you cannot translate Daseinsgelassenheit. If you have the right sense of humor, then you are always aware of that things pass anyway. All things pass, you know, human beings die. Some people say that the most crucial thing, one of the most crucial things for the Austrian soul or mentality were the times of Baroque, you know, after the 30-year war and all that. So Baroque art is very present in Austria, like Catholic Baroque art. And these were times when people were very much aware of mortality, very much aware of how things are passing. And at the same time, you try to accept this for a fact and sort of laugh about it. You say, okay, we die, but let's dance a waltz, you know, let's build up something anyway. Okay, this will decay, but we build up this magnificent Baroque church. But what I mean, that you can have this attitude towards the world that, you know, it is transient, it's passing, and so at the same time, you do things like precisely because of that. You're not becoming passive or so. You say precisely because of that, I'm building something, you know. And so I think this whole climate change thing is in fact a fear of death. It's nothing else. It's a fear. It's a savage fear of death and of nothingness. And of course, these are people that live in an age where all sort of spiritual religious beliefs are abandoned. And now comes this cult, this climate change cult. It's a sort of apocalyptic religion, and it's dead serious. And everything's turned dead serious. My mind says, my Austrian mind says, something is wrong. You see?
Yes, I was just looking for a quote to put to you. I think it was, "Let us eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die." Would you say that's a quote that you go by?
It's not exactly what I was talking about here.
Let us eat, drink, and be melancholy, yeah, for tomorrow we die.
It's of course this Epicurean thought. I mean, I think you should of course care about tomorrow and about your children and about things to go on. But the wisdom is that, you know, it's passing. I mean, okay, I don't want to sound too overblown now here. Probably all the thoughts I'm just developing here are not ripe yet, but my thoughts are jumping here a bit, but it's related. Think of this clown world meme that came up last year, I think, right?
Earlier this year, yes.
I think it came out of despair. It was an escape from despair, because obviously we face lots of absurdities. They crop up every day. If you are a professional conservative commentator, whether on YouTube or in a paper or so, you do this every day. You look up, wow, the Hydra, you know, the snake with the serpent with the many heads, has grown another head. Oh, let's cut off this head. And it's more, even more absurd than the one we saw yesterday. And you might get tired of it. And of course, many of us realize there's a sort of, you know, this Hydra is really, really big and the heads are growing every day. So how do you escape from despair? So I think the clown world thing was a way to step back and say, light, okay, let's see the comedy of it. Let's see the absurdity of it. I mean, if I can do anything else, I at least can maybe laugh at it. maybe some are forcing themselves to laugh at it. They don't really find it funny.
Yes,
they find it totally depressing and they get suicidal and whatever. But it's a way to step back, and I think many of us need it, because I see this thing also on the right wing that people all often get drawn into this feeling of doom, not unlike the climate change people. You know, what for them is the climate change, for us is the great replacement, for example. You know? And but the difference is that the great replacement is something you can see with your eyes. The climate change is something you have to believe in. At least the way it is presented to us. I mean, you can say, okay, I remember in my childhood there was more snow in winter, and I think it's true, but this is not climate, this is just weather. I mean, if I'm informed, so it's not a scientific thing. But great replacement, you can say, okay, I remember in my childhood there were less foreigners in the school classes than now. This is a fact, this is something that's happening. And so I see that there is always the danger of being sucked into this feeling of doom and of no way out and of depression. It's a great danger. I mean, I'm facing this danger myself, you know.
Yes, and I also do. I mean, I think we're both of a similar melancholic mindset where we are prone to depression. We have to be very careful about it.
Sure, of course. I mean, there's the famous saying by Nietzsche, you heard it a million times, you gaze into the abyss gazes back into you. And this happens. I mean, you have a price to pay for being, for seeing things clearly. This is also a difference between left and right, I guess, that, you know, people say that the left has this belief of, if you see things clearly, you will see good things because man is good. Things are inherently good. If you are conservative, you rather believe the opposite. You rather say, maybe man is a really difficult creature. There are a lot of dark things. This is why you have to have, you know, enforcement of morals and institution and law and all that kind of things. And so the same thing is the notion that once you start seeing things clearly, really clearly, you might get very depressed about it. Huh? I mean, I remember maybe, you know, I guess we should be closing soon, but I remember one of my favorite movies is from the 1970s by Robert Bresson, a French director, and it's a marvelous film about a young man in his 20s, and he's active in far-left groups, and he becomes disillusioned by them, and he comes to loathe them, and he's very depressed, and he gets sent to a psychiatrist. And there's a scene where he's a psychoanalyst, and he's talking to the psychoanalyst, and he says, well, we will look up your infantile complexes might have added to your sickness. And the young man says, well, I'm not sick. And the psychoanalyst says to him, well, of course you are, which is a funny moment. And the young man says, no, I'm not sick. My sickness is of seeing things too clearly. Hmm? In the end, he sort of suicides himself. He gets another friend of his to do the job, to kill him. But this always stuck in my mind, you know, that seeing too clearly can be very, very painful, and you have to have resources against that. I think this is a major thing for right-wing people to find resources to counter that. And just recently today, I talked to a friend who he converted to Catholicism some years ago, and he did it in a really radical way. He has a wife and a family, and he's a very complex and deep thinking guy. And he said to him, the most important thing is substance. How many people in the right wing scene do have the substance that they walk the talk? I mean, I guess you have been thinking about it as well, because for us, or for many of us, it's just these people who present their face on YouTube and who sell themselves as sort of influencers or whatever. And many of those have turned out to be frauds and shills and money grifters and all that. You know, it's depressing. And some are honest. Everybody needs to make money. We all need money. Money is important to have power and influence. But if you look up to certain people you see on the internet, you must not be blinded by their appearance. You must also realize that you have to walk the talk yourself. You have to get a substance in your life.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I think it's sorry to interrupt. I think it's important that people don't become overly reliant on people like me. In the end, only you can solve your own life. Only you can live your own life. And I think there is a danger that some people invest too much in the movement as a subculture. That I mean, I've got nothing against subculture, and I think it is a subculture. Mm. But I think, like any subculture, you shouldn't let it become the whole of your identity, and you certainly shouldn't think it's going to solve your problems for you, because it's not. I mean, it will guide you. It might be enlightening. It might be helpful. It might be something for you to belong to. It might give you things to do. But ultimately, it probably will not solve your problems. So
you have to build up something, even if it's a small, a family or whatever, that has
a family, a business, a project, something that gives your life meaning.
Substance, you know, you should not become a show for others, you know. And there are certain, I mean, for example, one that is admired by everybody is Jared Taylor. Nobody questions his integrity and his character, and so most people want to be like him, to have this almost Japanese balance, Zen-like state of mind and all that. And probably he has also his family in order, and his mind is very sober and all this. So I guess you have always to aim for yourself as well, and for your substance. It must not become a show. And you know, the more I think of it, I see that these big things, they are moving forward. Of course, I mean, we see the rise of populism, but we also see the corruption of politics. We see the corruption of all the people we believed in. I mean, people believe in Trump, but obviously he's in fact, the left is right about him, that he's a very corrupt and problematic character. So you look up to these people who are supposed to solve the world problems, and this is not enough. I mean, I always get thrown back to the position, where am I, you know, and where are we, and how to resist despair, how to find resilience, how to find substance. This is what I'm asking myself.
Yes. Well, because I was supposed to progress to another stream 25 minutes ago, so we do have some questions to rattle through, so we'll have to go through them very quickly.
Let's go.
Get through them. So the first one was, why aren't there any Austrian car brands?
I don't know about cars. That's my answer.
Okay.
I can't tell one car from another. My mind is too stupid for that.
Okay. What is the key distinction between patriotism and jingoistic nationalism?
Well, jingoistic nationalism, might say, is a blind thing. It's unquestioning, putting yourself above others, and thereby creating a lot of trouble. I mean, not only to others, but to your own country as well.
All right. Okay, that seems a fairly fair answer. Okay.
I make good answers now because you said so.
All right. Okay. I'll bear that in mind. Hold on a second. Can't unconditional love be used against us? Liberals say we have a moral obligation to love everyone unconditionally. So open borders now.
Yes, of course. I mean, it's a corruption of the idea of unconditional love. It's not love of your neighbor, but it's love of those that are really far away from you. If it says love your neighbor, it's the one you love that is close to you. But if you love the whole world, I mean, love doesn't have any sense anymore. And then it becomes, I mean, there's a word, altruistic, some perverted altruism. I think there's really a word for it, for this. It's a sort of
pathological altruism. Yeah.
it happens, you know, and this is, of course, a travesty, a parody of what unconditional love. Unconditional love, I think, should be is always directed at something very concrete, something visible, something that you really have a personal relationship to, and not something abstract. The more it opens, the more abstract it is, and then forget about it.
Yeah,
it becomes perverted.
Yeah,
that's what I would say.
Okay. Do you think the established parties in Germany, the CDU, the SPD, can continue to avoid cooperating with the AfD?
Well, that's a good question. I think they can. I mean, if AfD doesn't get over the 30% mark, they will avoid it as much as they can. You know, and this can drag on for many years.
Yeah. Well, okay. What do you believe is the best way forward to affect change politically on the national and international EU global level?
I have no idea. This question is too complicated for me.
Okay. Will there be any real change in Germany with the SPD gaining ground? I don't know anything about the SPD.
No, SPD is losing ground. SPD has the worst results in all history. They have no direction anymore. I mean, unlike in Denmark, the Social Democrats, you know, have a restrictive immigration policy and they have become more realistic. But German SPD is far away from this, and they are just self-destructing. And I don't see any change of direction here.
Right. Okay. Is Catholicism enjoying a resurgence in Germany thanks to the migrant crisis?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I see that groups of Catholics, similar as in France, where this is much stronger, this movement, they're not getting much bigger, but they're getting more intense. They're getting more, so it's not more people, but more intense people. It's happening in France. I'm not sure whether it's happening in Germany. I don't think it's happening to a significant extent. Because, right. I mean, most of Germany is secular or Protestant. I mean, Germany is not really a Catholic country. There are only Catholic parts, and there may be a few that become more intense, but they're not significant in number.
Right, okay. What can we do to break the stranglehold of the two-party system in modern politics?
The two-party system... What does it refer to? The two-party system?
Yeah, I think that's an Anglospheric sort of question, so we'll just ignore that one. Although opposed to the EU, how do Europeans intend to avoid being bullied by major foreign powers, e.g. China and America?
Yeah, well, this is a bigger question. I mean, I'm one who's advocating a sort of alternative European Union. I'm more a pan-European than a nationalist. I believe there should be some sort of, I would wish for some sort of European United States or empire to happen, which will not happen anytime soon, which is not very realistic. But by now, I don't see any way to go there, which doesn't mean that you don't have to think of ways to go there. So I think if you are a nationalist today, no matter what your persuasion is, you always have to think on a pan-European level because we are all in the same boat. From Finland to Portugal, whole Europe is now sharing a destiny, but it's very, very difficult to make the people conscious of this, that there is a shared destiny. They still have different kind of ideas and national narratives and problems in Finland and in Portugal, but they should realize that we are becoming, globally speaking, you know, one group with a shared destiny.
Yeah, I think you might be right. Can you think of examples of things that American right-wingers do that alienate Europeans? I think the first thing they do is constantly talk about America, and they don't seem to realize that things affect everyone else as well. They talk about... you take that question. Things that American right-wingers do that alienate Europeans.
I think that they talk about race all the time.
Oh?
Which is becoming an issue in Europe as well, yeah. But and I think it's a legit issue, certainly. But it's more thinking about that is more an American thing, which is very odd to many Europeans in the first place because of different history and of different conception of what you are. So the race story, it's a long, it goes back way into the beginnings of the United States, you know, the racial identities and questions. And we did not have this in Europe until the immigrants arrived in the 50s and 60s and so.
Yeah, but this seems to contradict, this seems to contradict your previous answer that Europeans are now sort of...
They are, but they're not conscious of it yet. This is also what I said. I said there's no, I think, you know, objectively speaking, they should realize they are in one boat now, but their conscious is not there yet. So right. From Finland to Portugal, they are not there yet. And I can tell you it does freak people out if you talk about race too much, especially if you are a German and you kind of language is sort of verboten, you cannot go there. And so, I mean, I think it will be important to speak about it in the future because the left is already doing it. Our left is copying the American left by talking about whiteness, white people all the time. So they are the ones who are starting the conversation about race also in Germany and in other countries. But until you realize that, okay, this is a battleground they drag you onto, and you have to answer to them, there's still some work to be done to make people conscious of that.
Yes. Okay. Shouldn't freedom or liberty be viewed as a preference rather than a goal? I think so.
Yes, the answer would be yes. I mean, it's also a very abstract concept. You always have to ask the freedom what to do and the freedom from what. And how is that freedom balanced within the interests of the common good? So freedom in itself is a nice sounding word which sounds really feel good, but it can have a lots of meanings. So you have to be specific what you mean with freedom here. What kind of freedom or liberty are you talking about?
Yes. Okay. Someone says thanks Woz, thanks to Underhill as well, please. That's JD Smith. I don't know what that's a reference to, but there we are. Okay. Is the current face of white European consciousness a new aspect of religiosity in an age without an overlying moral narrative? If we had a moral and healthy society, would race be a political issue? I think it would, but you take it.
Well, I mean, race becomes an issue if there's a clash of races, then you get conscious about it. You know?
Exactly. That's the whole point.
I mean, I would not want to live, you know, I think it's abhorrent the way the US is obsessed about race things. I don't want to live in a society that constantly thinks and talks about race. I think it's completely annoying, you know. But if you have this clash of races for immigration, and races are a fact and racial difference are a fact, then you have to talk about it, if you like it or not. I mean, I don't like it. I don't want to live in a society that is obsessed by race, but multiculturalism will inevitably lead to that. And here's also a thing that I think it's wrong to make a religion out of race. I see this with some American white nationalists. There are also some examples in history. It's not an end in itself. It's what you do with that race, which is more important.
Right. Okay. I would agree. Okay. Don't you think, and this comes from a German guy, don't you think that the guilt trip expands now so that you can't even be proud of producing high quality cars? What would you say about that?
You should sell the idea to the leftists. They are always eager to find new ways to feel guilty about. So you can connect this with Extinction Rebellion and with climate change things that you say, wow, German cars are also, you know, destroying the climate. Another thing to feel bad about. Hooray, hooray.
All right.
German cars are something to feel bad about. That's a great idea. Leftists will love you for this idea. You should sell it to them.
More fuel for the fire. Have you spoken with German Zoomers, that's Generation Z, teenagers? What do they think? Are they I mean, I don't think you will have you?
Not really. I mean, not to average ones, you know. I would talk to an occasional German swimmer who is attracted to identitarians or so, but I cannot really say that I have had contact with normie German swimmers, what they think. I could not make a statement on that.
Okay. Now, here's a question that I wish we could have a lot of time to discuss, but and maybe we should actually do a specific stream on this because it's so interesting to me. But I'm just going to give it to you just now. Germans are the largest group of European-descended people in America. It's the biggest component in the genetic mix in America is German. Can Martin see a German influence on America or any similarities between German culture and American culture? I think that's a fascinating question.
Yeah, it is. I mean, one thing I can say is that Germans are a group that assimilated very easily into this American, let's say, you know, Huntington would call it the Anglo-Protestant culture. And America, I would say, was a melting pot for white people. With others, it would not melt so much. But with the white, the European people that came in there, they would melt into it a lot, and Germans especially. So unlike other groups, for example, Italians or Irish, they don't melt so much. I mean, there are still some cities or towns or parts of America left that have a recollection of German immigration. Some have Oktoberfest or so. But as far as I know, it has almost disappeared. So, and I think this is a part of the German character, that they are able to disappear like this, that they are able to completely assimilate and all that, while others are more stubborn to assimilation. And keep more on to their identity. I mean, yeah, I say Irish Americans or Italian Americans are example among the white Americans, but the Germans not so much. But as Wo said, this is a fascinating thing that you would have to think about much more.
I once had a conversation with my American friend, Pale Hominid. He had a channel called Pale Hominid, and I once had this conversation with him. Actually, when I was living in Nuremberg, had a Skype call with him, and we talked about this for about 40 minutes, the German mentality, the English mentality, and the American mentality. And it was really a monologue from me talking about these different things, and I was really proud of it, and I thought, God, I hope that was recorded, because I had a Skype recorder at the time. The damn thing wasn't recorded. There was a glitch. It got lost, and it would have been a really, I was very proud of it at the time. I thought that was very interesting. I hope I can put that up on the channel.
I mean, it got lost. There's this American Israeli writer, Tuvia Tenenbaum. He writes quite interesting books, and one was called where he makes a road trip over America and he visits several people. And one thing is that he always looks for the traces of Germans in America. So he visits at one point a town which has German origins. And the result is always that it has almost completely dissolved itself. There are a few memories to it. I remember one scene where he meets a woman and she is proud of her German ancestry. And she says, oh, I just love Germany. I love German values. And he asks, what are German values? And she really can't find an answer to it. You see, it's just an emotion. And you have this town where you have a celebration and you have a few German songs, but mostly it has dissolved itself. So I get Germans assimilated them very thoroughly.
Yeah, of course, I get all of that. But what I mean is the psyche, the mentality. I think that the America is not Britain. There is a difference between America and Britain. And I think the difference is Germany. I think the difference is Germanness. That's what separates. I mean, obviously not nowadays with, you know, America is far more complicated now. But I think the white America, the difference between white America and Britain is Germany in its psyche. But anyway, I can't go into this now because it's a fascinating topic.
Me neither, and I cannot say anything competent about it. I have to look into it. before okay. Anything. But it would be interesting way to follow.
Well, I'll try to recreate my monologue from 2 years ago and wish me luck. Okay, so there are two more questions. Three more questions. How do you feel about Germany eliminating its fossil fuel energy, nuclear energy, and basically deindustrializing?
How do I feel about that? And is it happening? I never thought.
They closed down all their nuclear power plants. I know they did that.
No, they don't have nuclear power plants. Yeah, well.
I wonder how Kraftwerk feel about that.
Honestly, I can't give an honest answer to that. I haven't thought about it enough.
Okay. All right. The two final questions. Martin has mentioned several German philosophers tonight. Who is his favorite?
My favorite German philosopher? Well, that would be Nietzsche.
Okay.
But I'm not really a Nietzschean. This is the funny thing. But Nietzsche would have loved it. I mean, he's the one who writes, has the best writing, is the most exciting to read. So I guess he would be the one I would call my favorite.
Okay.
He was also a great poet. He wrote great poems. He was a poet philosopher. And you can actually understand what he wrote, unlike Heidegger, which is very hard to decipher and who has not been translated into German yet.
Okay. All right. What are the top three books to understand the modern world?
The top three books to understand the modern world. Well, it depends. I mean, there are a few in German, a few in English. I mean, probably I would have to name those that are available in English to understand. I think this is a far too broad question. I cannot answer it either that briefly. No.
Okay. Yeah. I think that Martin should have his own YouTube channel because I think he's full of thoughts and ideas and it's always fascinating talking to him. But in the meantime, this has been a very interesting conversation. I'm sorry that it couldn't go on a bit longer, but I'm nearly an hour late for the Franklin. So, it would be good to have you on again soon, Martin. But in the meantime, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2019.
Thank you for inviting me. I wish you a happy new year, 2020, and maybe we talk again next year.
Oh, I hope so.
It's my third time on Millennial now, you know?
It is. Lots of people in the chat are saying, create a channel, Martin. Do it, Marty.
Give me money so I'll...
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'll be back soon with the Franklin. And this was I loved this one. So thank you, Mark. Thank you very much.
Bye.
See you later.